This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the coroner for East Baton Rouge Parish, Dr. Louis Cataldi says he served as the state's official witness to the worst that humanity has to offer, investigating some of the most despicable crimes and violent deaths imaginable. But, he adds, nothing compared to the sheer devastation of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. After Katrina struck, Dr. Cataldi was appointed Louisiana's first state medical examiner and given the job of running the makeshift morgue in St. Gabriel outside New Orleans. He oversees the process of identifying the dead bodies that have been found on the field and determining the causes of death. So far, 910 such bodies have been found. 50 remain unidentified. The memoir that Dr. Cataldi had been writing was ready to go to press at the end of the summer. Just before publication, he added a few pages about his work with Katrina victims. The book has just been published. It's called Coroner's Journal, Stalking Death in Louisiana. Just an aside to parents, we're going to be talking about his work after the hurricane in ways that may be too graphic for children. Are there still bodies being found?
Yes, ma'am, there are. In the Ninth Ward, we currently have cadaver dogs there because some of those buildings are scheduled for demolition, and we certainly don't want anybody's mother being bulldozed into a trash pile. We won't tolerate that. So what we're doing is, what New Orleans Fire Department is doing, and the state is just supporting these folks, is that they're going in, seeing if there are human remains. They're taking the houses apart in a way that allows the dogs to gain entry, if you would. By taking out some areas, they allow the house to breathe, and if there are human remains inside, the dog can detect that. People ask me, can the dogs detect human remains 6 months after they're deceased? The answer to that is absolutely true. I can tell you that the New Orleans Police Department was in a house on Lakeview on the 3rd, I believe it was, or the 2nd, could not find human remains. The cadaver dog went in 2 days later, and within 30 seconds had found the deceased individual who was lodged between some ductwork in the attic. So the dogs are very beneficial.
Is the process of identifying the hurricane victims any different from the standard process of, not that there is a standard process, I suppose, of identifying a body? I mean, what are some of the challenges that you were hit with identifying Katrina victims?
Well, the challenges have been legion, actually, because we didn't get to recover those human remains until several days after the death had occurred. And, of course, we're still recovering people 6 months later, so time and the natural decomposition process has taken its toll on our ability to identify these folks. Of course, many people drifted. They have no identifiers, and they have no clothing. And at this point in time, we have approximately 50 people, actually 46, who we cannot identify, and we're hoping that family members will come forward and we'll be able to identify those people with DNA.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of the bodies that have come to you are already in the process of decomposing. I would think that bodies who died in the flood would decompose more rapidly, or at least become more disfigured by being in the water, and maybe make it harder for you to identify them.
The water, and certainly, as you know, it was a toxic type situation with the water, due to the chemicals that had floated up, as well as due to the bacteria from the sewage lines that were floating up into the water. So that certainly, in all probability, it helped the death, helped the decomposition process accelerate. We also have people, unfortunately, who were caught up in attics and they couldn't get out because the water was lapping at the ceiling inside the house, so they couldn't get out. And the temperatures of 110 degrees or more made them susceptible to dehydration and, of course, heat stroke, heat exhaustion, and ultimate death.
So what tools do you use when you're dealing with, say, a body that was in the water, in the toxic water for a long time?
Unfortunately, many of these bodies have drifted, and so we don't have even the benefit of an address. And, of course, there was the fact that most of the street signs in many of these areas were down anyway, so it was quite difficult. Houses were moved, so an address wasn't that beneficial. A house could be on one street, and now it's four, five streets over. So addresses weren't very beneficial. That's one major issue that we had. Not having identifiers makes it extremely difficult. And when the first thing, of course, we would try to look for is any type of identifier, such as a tattoo or things like that. Failing that, we certainly look to orthopedic devices that somebody may have, pacemakers, personal effects. Fingerprinting, we had some initial success there, but as time went on, of course, the decomposition process and animal activity made that impossible because, unfortunately, the animals tend to attack the smaller bones of the hands. And so we lost that capability. Of course, we maintained the x-ray capability, and we maintained dental capability, but unfortunately, many of the records in the dental clinics were flooded, and the forays in there to get those dental records have met with mixed success, although we have successfully identified very many people successfully through dental x-rays, primarily through the efforts of Dr. Doug Cross, who was a local dentist who's gone back in there and helped retrieve those records. And failing that, we're now at the part where we're relying almost totally on DNA.
Yeah, so how does the DNA process work? Are a lot of families who've lost loved ones sending DNA evidence of those loved ones to you so you could try to match it?
Well, we have, I hate to keep talking about how many problems we have, but every victim, we took a piece of tibia, a bone sample, and all those victims have DNA profiles that have been run. But if I've got 1,400 missing people, researching 1,400 families makes it quite difficult. Therefore, we're requesting that if people have found their loved ones and had reported them missing, that they call in to us so that we can stop the search for somebody who's already been found. It is quite a monumental task to gather DNA on thousands of people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Louis Cataldi. He's the Louisiana State Medical Examiner, and he's been overseeing the identification of the dead after Hurricane Katrina. He's also written a new book. It's called Coroner's Journal, Stalking Death in Louisiana. What were some of the typical causes of death that you've seen in the hurricane victims?
Well, certainly we saw the drownings, and unfortunately, we even had children who were swept away from rooftops and ultimately drowned. So drowning was a major factor. But a lot of these folks were elderly, and they just refused to leave. And an elderly person who may have survived the hurricane and thought they were home free, unfortunately, succumbed to the floods that followed. And as I mentioned earlier, the dehydration and the fact that if you're a diabetic and you're stuck in your attic with no insulin, it's just a matter of time until you enter a diabetic coma. I suspect lots of these people died in delirium and heat exhaustion. They were horrible deaths.
One of the things you have to do as medical examiner is to rule out foul play when you're looking at a body. Did you have to rule out foul play in the bodies that came to you after Katrina?
Yes, that's absolutely true. Because when human remains were retrieved and brought to the victim identification unit or the morgue, what happened is that they were examined immediately by a forensic pathologist. If there was any indication at all of foul play, that pathologist stopped the entire process. The jurisdictional coroner, Dr. Minyard in Orleans Parish, Dr. Bertucci in St. Bernard Parish, was immediately notified that case was immediately labeled a forensic case, and it went into the jurisdiction and autopsy by that coroner or his pathologist.
Is it hard to tell whether somebody was murdered or died in the flood when their body has been in the flooded toxic water for a long time?
Actually, that depends on who you've got doing the examination, and we had some really good folks doing that. You can certainly ascertain trauma. Now, initially, you may miss something like a gun wound, but if you missed a gunshot wound, ultimately the total body x-ray is going to pick up the fragment if it's there. Total body x-ray is going to also pick up any broken bones and things like that that might show a track of a bullet. So although some people said this is a great time to kill somebody, which is totally ludicrous, the forensics are still there, and nobody's given up on trying to find the perpetrator.
Did you find many bodies that appeared to be murdered?
Actually, I believe, and Dr. Minyard could certainly correct me on this, I believe we had 18 total gunshot wounds. Some of those were self-inflicted. You know, the suicide rate anecdotally appears to have increased. We had people, first responders, who would go home and find their families drowned and subsequently take their own lives.
Would you describe the morgue that you set up after the hurricane?
The initial ward was set up in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. They had taken over a school and a warehouse, and that warehouse functioned quite well as far as I was concerned. Initially, when the human remains was brought into the facility, we did spray them down with the chlorine mix, if you would. From there, they went through a series of stations. Now, a tracker is assigned, or an escort, if you would, to each person, each human remains that entered that facility, in order to make sure there's, number one, all the stations were seen and everything was met, and also that completes the chain of custody. So the tracker essentially goes through administration, and the person is initially examined, as I said, by a forensic pathologist to determine whether or not that person would continue to go into our process or would immediately go into the coroner's jurisdiction as a case of had a high index of suspicion of foul play, such as a head injury or something like that. From there, photographs are taken. All the personal effects are photographed. All the clothing is photographed. The next step, of course, would be that we would attempt to get fingerprints if a person was fingerprintable. The next station would be the dental, and they have a tremendous system called the DEXA system. If indeed we have retrieved your dental x-rays and having put them into the system, and we take your x-ray, it searches that database that we've even put it into the system and can get a match within about 45 minutes, which is really great news. But interestingly enough, a lot of the times the dental records, the emulsification had come off, so what we had instead of an x-ray was just a clear piece of plastic, if you would. But it had been imprinted on the envelope itself, so you could open up the envelope, take a mirror image picture of that, and you had the dental x-ray. And so those are some of the things that those forensic dentists were able to do in order to get a match. It was really, really great. So we were very, very pleased with the outcome there. We had a lot of good dental identifications, which is as good as a fingerprint, obviously. From there, the person goes into anthropology in an attempt to ascertain the age of the individual, utilizing the symphysis pubis and utilizing some of the ends of the ribs. The anthropologist can get a pretty good idea of the person's age. They can also get a pretty good idea of racial characteristics based on primarily examination of the skull. And if you've got a person who's totally unknown and whose skin has decomposed, that's extremely beneficial to us. Anthropology can also look for any type of unusual compression fractures of vertebrae and things like that. The next station, of course, would be the autopsy station. Autopsies were under the jurisdictional coroner. Mostly in this case, of course, it was Dr. Frank Minyard of Orleans Parish. We also did total body x-rays, as I mentioned earlier, and that's extremely important because if you've got a pacemaker, I can get your identity relatively quickly. And, of course, we also are looking for orthopedic appliances and things like that. And upon completion of that, the person is put back into a fresh body bag and put back into a refrigeration area.
Did you have adequate refrigeration for all the bodies that came to you?
Actually, we relied on refrigeration trucks, and we did have adequate refrigeration, but, you know, even in refrigerated situations, there's a certain amount of decomposition that's going to take place, albeit very slowly. A certain amount of decomposition does take place. So most of our work was accomplished there at St. Gabriel, and then, of course, another facility was built at Carville. Both of these facilities are federal facilities.
So the trucks that you were using, the refrigerator trucks, were these trucks that usually deliver refrigerated foods?
Well, of course, once you use a truck for this purpose, it can no longer be utilized for that. And these were primarily, from what I understand, FEMA trucks or FEMA rentals.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Louis Cataldi. He's the Louisiana State Medical Examiner. He's been overseeing the identification of the dead after Hurricane Katrina. And he's written a new memoir, which is called Coroner's Journal, Stalking Death in Louisiana. You're a man who was always surrounded by the dead. I mean, that's your job. But I imagine you've never been surrounded by so many bodies at one time, so many bodies who, you know, people who died from the same cause. What impact has it had on you personally to be doing this work after Katrina?
Well, Terry, most of the nightmares have stopped. At least I believe they have. I can tell you that walking through hospitals and stepping over human remains was perhaps one of the most difficult things or impacting things that's ever happened to me. You can see that there were valiant efforts at these hospitals, and the electricity was out, and You can see people who still have oxygen on and respirators in place, but there was no electricity, no oxygen, so a valiant battle, but in the end, a lot of folks died. It's just, it's pretty horrific walking through a hospital that's all torn up and the windows are blown out and dead bodies are there. And, you know, these guys tried everything they could, and that's tough.
You mentioned nightmares. Do you usually have nightmares? Was this unusual?
It's unusual for me, but, you know, you're impacted with these things, and the best thing you can do is talk about them, but unfortunately the intensity was such that you really didn't have much of a time to break and talk to folks about it. And, you know, subsequently down the road, of course, you get to talk about things, and that's real important. It's important to share those experiences and get them out in the open.
What were the nightmares like?
Oh, I remember one vividly of having all these people at the morgue walking by me, telling me to find them and get them home. And that was a kind of a recurrent theme for a while there. It's like they would just kind of float by and say, hey, you know, I'm so-and-so. You're supposed to find me, and you're supposed to find my kids and get me home. So let's talk about something else.
Yeah, I will say that's a nightmare, but that's kind of how you describe your responsibilities in your book, as being, like, responsible to the dead. They don't talk to you in real life, but you still feel that sense of responsibility to them.
Well, when you look at the photographs that people have sent in of their loved ones, because we need photographs and we need smiling photographs, because even if we don't have dental records, if we've got a smiling photograph, lots of times we can match some of the dental characteristics with the smile on what we're finding in the morgue. And you look at those smiling photographs and you see people with their families, and, you know, you really want to get them back home. You know, I'm talking about yearbooks that have a picture that was taken in the 1950s. We can still use that even now. If there's some unusual dentition, we can match that dentition picture against someone and get a tentative ID. And if I've got a tentative ID, I know which family members to call to get DNA.
You write in your book that you had asked the chaplains to say ecumenical prayers over each of the remains when they were found. Why did you want to do that?
Lots of reasons for that. I think it's an ecumenical prayer. It's a prayer of thanksgiving. I think our people deserve that. They deserve that dignity. It also assured me, let me tell you, a chaplain in the field is a good thing to have, because if anything disrespectful is going on, they're going to come, number one, they're going to intervene, number two, they're going to let me know about it. So I guess I kind of double dipped there, because they were excellent quality control in addition to providing the dignity and the prayer of thanksgiving for those folks. I owe a lot to those guys who went out in the field and did that.
What is the prayer?
I don't have it in front of me. It's essentially a prayer of thanksgiving, the same prayer that was used at the World Trade Center. It simply says that we're thankful for the person being found. We're thankful for the persons who found them, and we hope that the person will be made whole in the arms of God.
You know, obviously the chaplains are very important to you. At the same time, you describe an experience with a chaplain who sat down next to you after the hurricane and gave you what you describe as a TV evangelical smile. And you write, I wonder if he practices it in front of the mirror. And then you got really kind of annoyed with him, and you describe him as, quote, the kind of guy who goes back and tells his buddies how much stress I was under and how he was blessed to be there for me. You say that you've met a lot of chaplains. Some of them are here for the right reasons, and some are here for themselves. What do you mean by some are here for themselves?
Well, and again, that may be my own projection. The guy may be a 100% stand-up guy. It was a particularly horrific day. I'd been out there in the field with chaplains who were out there doing the deal, who were out there helping recover human remains, who were going up in those houses, who were there for the sights and the sounds, and who were getting out there filthy with me and who smelled of death. And you know, these guys really understand. I guess the guy just, I'll give him the benefit of a doubt. He caught me wrong, and he had this nice clean shirt and, you know, was going to ask me how I'm doing. It just didn't hit me right at the time. And, you know, I got the impression that some of the folks who were coming down may have had their own agendas, and I don't know that. I guess I shouldn't be projecting or judging. But the bottom line is, you can tell the people who are real and who have been there. I don't need somebody who comes up and tells me how many disasters they've been to. Right off the bat, when somebody tells me that, I get that creepy feeling in the back of my neck, and it's almost as if it we're keeping score or has a bunch of pins on as to different disasters they've encountered. I this isn't about keeping score. This is about my people. And I don't know. I guess this guy caught me wrong, Terry, and I just didn't feel the sincerity. And could have been about me.
One of the things you have is like your coroner's kit. What do you have in your kit?
Well, when I was coroner, I had all sorts of things in that kit, and it kind of just grew from needing things. Of course, you have your protective equipment, that's as gloves. You need lighting sources. Some of the unique things that you need, of course, is a thermometer in order to be able to take a body temperature. That can either be a rectal temperature or an organ temperature. I usually prefer the liver, quite honestly. So you have to have a scalpel. You also have to have a marker pen. If I was in a situation in which I needed to determine a time of death or bracket a time of death, or certainly get the information where I can go back and bracket the time of death, I would probably put a circle just under the right rib of the right lower rib cage, make an incision there, and I take pictures as I do this entire process. I take an ambient temperature of the room and subsequently insert the thermometer into the liver, allow that temperature to stabilize, take that temperature, remove that thermometer and take another ambient reading. So I've got those readings bracketed. And there are various normograms you can use to back out time of death or bracket in time of death. Roughly a human body cools in Louisiana at about 1 to 1.5 degrees per hour. That is extremely a thumbnail type sketch or response, and there are some normograms that you can utilize. But that's in order to rule in or rule out a time bracket will certainly come into play when a suspect has an alibi or doesn't have an alibi for a certain time. So that's something I always keep with me. I always keep an alternate light source so we can turn out the lights and just look through an orange-type shield as the alternate light source puts out a kind of a blue glow. And we're looking for things like semen or any type of stain that might be on the body or in the area. So that's something else I certainly always keep in that kit. Always keep in there any appliance I might need, such as to get into a lock facility or down in the car. Of course, I always have some snips that I can snip through a lock if I have to, but usually the police are far ahead of me on that, so I never had to worry about things like that. And in Louisiana now, matter of fact, it's legislature that we push forward, the coroner is allowed to be armed. And, of course, that was something I adhered to.
So you carry arms with, what do you carry, a gun?
Yeah, we get into some pretty heavy situations at times, and I've always been armed.
Have you ever had to use the gun?
Thank God I've never had to use my gun on any person.
You know, one of the things you have to do as a coroner or medical examiner is determine the time of death. And one of the tools you have for that when a body is already decomposing is examining the maggots. I found this fascinating. Could you talk about how you do that?
Well, luckily for me, early on in my career, I met Dr. Lamar Meek, who was unfortunately has passed on, but he was really a great guy, a great teacher. And he taught me a whole lot about that. When a body dies, usually at first light, it's not going to happen at night, a blowfly is there to lay her eggs. And she can find that body almost within minutes. And so even within minutes, if it's during the daylight, in all probability, the fly is there and the fly is laying the eggs. So the eggs go through a normal process of going to maturity, and there are different stages of maggots. And those stages of maggots can tell you, within adequate time brackets, as to how long they've been there. For instance, if it takes 8 hours to reach a certain stage, by definition, you collect the maggot, you raise the maggot, you make sure that's the type of blowfly that you're, I think it was, and you can back out their life cycles. And it's been extremely beneficial because as they continue to go through various stages, they also go through migration, in which they'll actually burrow into the ground and migrate away from the body. I'll never forget the first time that Dr. Meek grabbed up a bunch of dirt and grass roots about 2 feet from the body. It was full of maggots, and to show me that the migration patterns were there. So those migration patterns, that level of maturity, and you'll see people over the body gathering up the flies with the net to ascertain what type of fly is laying the egg. And you have to also back off about the temperature. Are the remains in the shade? How long have they been in the shade? Was it a cloudy day? Was it a wet day? And those are all things that the experts do to come back to us and say, here, we can give you approximate date of death and things like that, which, again, is very beneficial.
Did it take you a while before you could take this empirical attitude toward the maggots? Did it take you a while of not being overcome by feeling sick, seeing them?
You know, the first time I saw those maggots was in a prostitute who had been killed, and there's a possibility that she is related to a serial killing. I don't know that, but the index of suspicion is there early on in my career, and to see that type of activity initially, it backs you up a little bit. It certainly did me, but what you do, of course, is that you have to realize that that's evidence there, and you just do what you need to do, you know, get over it and get what you need to do, compartmentalize that. And in this particular situation, the maggots had accumulated, as they do on most orifices, but also at a wound site, which is quite commonly what they will do. And if a person, let's say a person is stabbed to death or they've been shot in the chest, quite often, in addition to other areas where maggots might accumulate, they'll also accumulate at the site of that trauma. So that's a clue right off the bat that this is a place to look. And of course, you can also extrapolate from the maggots, if you would. You can make a maggot slurry and do drug screens and subsequently see if there were drugs present on the human on which the maggots were feeding.
My guest is Dr. Louis Cataldi. He's the Louisiana State Medical Examiner overseeing the identification of the dead after Hurricane Katrina. He's the former coroner of East Baton Rouge Parish, and now he's the author of the new book, Coroner's Journal, Stalking Death in Louisiana. If this isn't too personal, has working with dead bodies affected your sense of what, if anything, happens to us after death?
Well, what, if anything, happens to us after death? You know, my belief is that it does, and my belief that there's evil and good in this world, and my personal opinion is that ultimately we'll be judged by what we do. So I think there is. I think people live on after death for lots of reasons and lots of ways. Certainly we live on in memories of our loved ones. I can certainly tell you that from the families of the victims of Derek Todd Lee, that these people will live on forever and from generation to generation. And I believe that there's innate good in people, and I believe that there's evil in people, and I just hope we try to stay on the right side of that.
You have a son, and you write something very funny in your book about him. You say, how many 11-year-olds go tracking across the shopping mall to describe the splatter pattern of a leaky garbage can that's been moved across the floor? So obviously your son has learned a few of the tricks of the trade.
Yeah, when he did that, I was somewhat startled. That's one of the reasons I said maybe I should journal all this, and at least from my perspective of it.
But there's probably a lot you want to protect your son from. I mean, there's probably a lot you want to teach him and a lot that you really don't want him to know.
Well, I think it's good to know things, but you don't necessarily have to experience them themselves. I think it's good to be able to learn from others. Certainly a failing of mine throughout my youth, and I'm sure one that we all suffer from to some level. But also, I think it's impossible for someone you live with, especially someone as impressionable as a child, it's impossible for me to have done what I had done and not bring some of it home. He can see me on TV escorting dead bodies. He knows what's going on. And I was somewhat shocked at some of the things he had picked up just by being around me, the garbage can being one, and talking about trace evidence and things like that, when popcorn's on your shirt from the movie. I mean, just little things like that kind of clue you, and, you know, I don't want a mini muck on my hands.
We're recording this interview in the morning. What happens to the rest of the day now? Are you going back to the morgue? And what what work is in store for you today?
Actually, today I'll be traveling to the 9th Ward again. I'll also be visiting with Dr. Minyard. As you may or may not know, we have several hundred casketed remains in a warehouse in New Orleans. Then I'll go to the 9th Ward and I'll check on the dog teams to make sure we're supporting them in any way the state needs to support those folks. New Orleans Fire Department's doing a tremendous job down there.
These are the recovery dogs you're talking about,
yes,
who are looking for bodies.
That's correct. Cadaver dogs.
Cadaver dogs.
Yes. And from there, I'll be going to Merrick Cemetery to do a survey on the damage done there with some of the folks out of Washington, D.C. And then from there, I'll be preparing to do a presentation at Delgado College tomorrow on how embalmers and morticians can help in preparedness for mass disasters. Otherwise, I don't have much left for the day.
Well, listen, I really want to thank you so much for describing the work that you've been doing. I really appreciate it. Thank you, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Louis Cataldi is the Louisiana State Medical Examiner and author of the new memoir, Coroner's Journal. He spoke to us from WRFK in Baton Rouge. You can find an excerpt of his memoir on our website, freshair.npr.org.